Well, hello, good morning to you. It's 11:05. It's Abbey 104 on Sunday morning, and it's Folk Tales. And in the studio this morning, we have our very own Paul Peters. Good morning, Paul.
And a very good morning to you.
We've done this before. It's a bit deja vu, this, isn't it?
Yeah, this is the third episode, I think, isn't it, in my life story.
We never really worked out at the outset how many episodes there were going to be. But this is number three. I don't know whether we'll get through it all, but there could be a fourth.
There's an awful lot there. I'll write the book one day.
Anyway, welcome. And just to reflect on last time, so I was listening back to it the other day, and we talked about your early life, how you were up in the pirate ships.
Well, I was on a pirate fort, actually, yes. Not a ship. I was on a fort.
All right. And you came back off that, and then you worked in a recording business for a little while. You were doing some management. You were a cleaner.
Oh, I've done lots of cleaning. I'm still cleaning. I clean and clean and clean. It's my thing in life.
And then after that, you took a job with the PDSA.
That's right. Well, I didn't actually apply for a job. I was... I don't know what happened, really. I took two African spears into a PDSA gift shop, one of the early gift shops, and I stayed almost 15 years. Yeah, absolutely amazing. And I loved it.
You eventually became their appeals director, didn't you?
That's right. Yeah, from London and the southeast of England. So I covered the whole of, the whole of the bottom corner, the southeastern corner of the UK for the PDSA. Yeah, fantastic job. Absolutely loved it.
Well, from the last recording, you really enjoyed the job, I know, but you eventually decided it was time to move on. I just reflect on why you decided
to
do that.
Well, I'd always wanted to run my own business. I mean, going back, I probably didn't tell you, my first enterprise was selling holly outside a pub when I was about 9. Yeah, I didn't tell you that bit, did I?
No.
And it was three pieces of holly for threepence. And that enterprise didn't stay very long because my aunt, who was a little bit on the posh side, we will say, her brother owned a house. It was a little bit like Mrs. Bouquet. Her brother owned a house with a swimming pool and a paddock room for a pony, you know, that sort of thing. And she saw me outside a pub in East Barnet Village selling holly. And she was absolutely horrified, absolutely horrified. So I'd always wanted to go back into business, we'll say. And after working for the PDSA for nearly 15 years, I decided it was time to start my own little enterprise. And Jeff, who I've mentioned before, who was my partner, we'd been together for, getting on for 10 years. And I persuaded him to go into business with me. I said, let's buy a hotel. He said, a hotel? What do you want a hotel for? I said, well, I've always fancied a hotel. I used to like programmes like Fawlty Towers and the Duchess of Duke Street and things like that on the television. I thought it would be rather glamorous running a hotel. And so we decided that we would try and buy a hotel. Well, I had nothing. I had no money at all when I started. But over the years, I bought these little dilapidated little cottages and things and moved on. And gradually I had got to buying a derelict house in South London. And we decided that I would sell my derelict house. And Jeff said, oh, we want to go to XYZ company, rather good company. They're based in Chelsea. I said, I can't get my little house on that. Well, it wasn't so little. My big house, we'll say, on the market with this company in Chelsea. I mean, they're not going to want my tatty place. Anyway, Jeff got in touch with them and they came down and they thought it was absolutely fabulous. And the guy literally sold the house within an hour of coming and seeing it. And the money that we got from the house and some money that Jeff had, we decided we would buy a hotel. So we did.
And the interest in hotels, Jeff, I think you said, was a great cook.
Yeah.
But
he always wanted a restaurant.
Yeah.
I always wanted a hotel.
Yeah. That was just some notion that you
had. Well, the idea was that he would have a restaurant in the hotel and I would look after the other side, the guests and the glamorous side, as I thought it would be, front of house, I suppose you would call it. And that was the idea. But it wasn't quite like that when it came down to it, because I spent my life making beds and cleaning rooms and unblocking toilets and dealing with Well, we were lucky. We didn't have very many difficult customers. I think over the whole of the time that we had the hotel, we had three what I would call difficult customers. But
you were quite used to domestication because you'd been cleaning.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I was all right on the cleaning side. Yeah. And I quite liked that side of it. I liked making the beds and the linen coming back from the laundry all beautifully starched. Well, not starched, but pressed where it's done sort of so beautifully. And I liked that. I liked that side, making the rooms look nice and buying bits of, I don't know, bric-a-brac and old pictures and things from junk shops and things and little bits of old furniture and trying to make the place, which was basically a seaside hotel, into something a little bit more glamorous than a seaside hotel.
And just to put a timeline on this, was the latter part of 1985 you bought the hotel.
That's right, yep.
And
yep.
Then I think you said you had to go and put ensuite rooms into
bedrooms. Put ensuites. I'm just trying to think. We started with three. We actually got a plumber to plumb in three ensuite rooms for us, and they were our best rooms. So we got £1 a night extra for those. And then the following year we decided that if the plumber could do it, we saw what he did, I could do it, and I put in quite a few more. In the following winter, we were basically a seasonal hotel, so we used to open at Easter and close round about this time of the year, middle of October, something like that. And then we reopened for Christmas. We were open for, I think it was three nights, or maybe four nights at Christmas, and then we would close again until Easter. And in those closed periods, we would be decorating, we would be putting in the en-suites and doing all sorts of things like that.
So there wasn't any jetting off for the sun then during the winter? You were still working?
I didn't jet off. Well, the last time that Jeff and I jetted off to the sun was 1984. And I haven't been to the sun since 1984.
You're overdue, Paul. We should talk about that. Yeah. Anyway, the hotel then opened in the Easter of 86.
Yeah, we actually opened under false pretenses, really, at Christmas 85, because there was a large hotel on the other side of the road which had 69 bedrooms. And rather sadly for them, there was a little bit of a storm. This was a sort of pre-hurricane, which we had down on the Thanet coast, and there was quite a lot of damage done over the Christmas period 1985, and they lost, well, most of the roof of their hotel. And Sam came running across, he was the owner, and he said, oh dear, my customers, there's no roof on the hotel, can you put some of them up? So we said, well, no, we're not open. He said, oh, we're desperate, absolutely desperate. So we decided that we would, I think we let them have a dozen rooms. And we thought, well, the money will come in handy. So we had a dozen of their clients or customers staying with us. And I said, well, we can't do food. We've got no food in the house. You know, you'll have to do the food over in your restaurant and all the rest of it, breakfast and dinner and all the rest of it over there. But they can sleep here. And, of course, Muggins was washing the towels and things. And I was out in the garden putting the towels on the line. And I looked up. And I suddenly realised that we hadn't got a roof on our hotel either. So we were charging these people, or charging the hotel across the road, to put up their guests because they hadn't got any roof and they were frightened that there'd be a storm or something and the guests would all get wet. And we didn't have a roof on the back of our hotel either.
Interesting. Is that an appropriate moment to take your first track?
Yeah, I don't know what we're going to play.
Well,
what have I got?
Jimmy Scott, Someone to Watch Over Me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's
why that one?
That one, because that is one of Jeff's favourites. He was a big, big fan of Jimmy Scott. Jimmy Scott was a little guy that never went into puberty, if that's the right term. He put on a little spurt of growth when he got to about 35, 36. I think he put on 6 inches or something. But he never really grew up. He had the most beautiful voice, and Jeff absolutely adored him. Sadly, he died about, 3-4 years ago, something like that.
Let's have the music. Someone to Watch Over Me by Jimmy Scott.
There's a somebody I'm longing to see. I hope that she turns out to be someone to watch. Oh. would to someone who'd watch over me.
That's Jimmy Scott and Someone to Watch Over Me from, well, 1992, I think the recording was. I think it may have been done before that.
Yeah.
It's a George and Ira Gershwin song from the 1926 musical OK.
Gosh, he's so knowledgeable, isn't he?
And Jimmy Scott, you were reflecting there, he was a countertenor and he actually had a condition called Coleman's syndrome,
which meant that he never actually
reached puberty, as you say. Paul is our guest in the studio, Paul Peters, who's had a fantastically interesting life
in radio
and many, many other things besides. And, Paul, we got to the stage where you were running a hotel in Margate, which I think was quite successful on the whole, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. Yes, it was. I mean, back in those days, we used to say that we were in Cliftonville because Cliftonville was the posh end of Margate. But these days, we happily say it was Margate because Cliftonville has become the rough end. So we don't mention Cliftonville anymore. But yeah, it was successful. We had a lot of fun. We enjoyed it. It was blooming hard work, and I don't recommend it to anybody. Don't go into the hospitality business unless you really, really are prepared to work hard. So many people decide that when they get old, they're going to retire and they're going to have a little pub in the country. Oh, don't do that. It's the worst thing you could possibly do. You never finish working. And it's the same with a hotel or a small bed and breakfast. You never, ever finish. If you want to run it properly, you are there 24 hours a day. You walk around, you see little bits of paper on the floor, you see little bits of cotton, and you pick them up and you make sure the place is pristine the whole of the time.
It is hard work, I know. Any interesting events happened while you were running
your
hotel?
Well, we had, I think one of the best events was we had this couple and they came from Nottingham, it was, I remember, Nottingham, and they booked in. They wanted a room. They didn't want to pay the extra pound a night for an ensuite room, but they wanted to be as close to a bathroom as possible. So I put them in number 4, and we had a lot of correspondence. Don't forget, this is before the internet, so we're writing letters backwards and forwards. And they wanted to know all the ins and outs of this room, exactly where it was, what the view was like and everything. And they knew all about it. They arrived one Saturday lunchtime, and I said to them, as we always did, would you like to come down to the lounge and have some tea with us or coffee and, you know, can we get you a sandwich or something if you've had a long journey? Or would you rather I bring it up to your room? And they said, no, we'll come down. Anyway, they went up to their room, and within literally 30 seconds, the chap was down. He was banging on the kitchen door. And I said, can I help you? So he said, yes, the room is not satisfactory. So I said, oh, dear, what's the problem? So he said, well, you better come up. I went up there, and I said, what is the problem? And he said, there's a spider up there. And I looked up and I said, oh, yes. I said, a little money spider. He said, this room has not been cleaned. I said, I can assure you it has because I did it myself. He said, well, that spider's there. I said, yes, sir, if you look, you know, we're in the middle of July. The windows are open and the spider's probably just run in. well, I can't have that. I said, no, and I can't have you. I said, don't bother to unpack. You're leaving. They looked at me. I'd found my feet. Up until that point, I'd always been, you know, nothing was too much trouble. I said, no, don't take anything out, madam. Just leave your case as it is because you're leaving. And I just marched out of the room and I went downstairs and I said to Jeff, the people in number four, I said, they're not stopping. Don't bother with their tea. So he said, oh, what's wrong? I said, they found a money spider in their room and they don't like it. So I've told them to get out. You can't do that. He said, we need the custom. I said, well, I'm sorry. I will not have them in my hotel telling me that I have not cleaned the room when I know very well I have. He goes running up the stairs. He's up there for 2 or 3 minutes. And he comes down and says, they are staying. He said, put the kettle back on. I said, well, if they stay, I'm not dealing with them. I'm having nothing to do with them. Anyway, the guy came down and he said to me, I'm going to give you a day. He said, try you out for a day. And if you're not satisfactory, we'll leave. I said, no, you won't. I said, you're not staying. I said, I won't have you in the hotel. Anyway, Jeff said, yes, they are staying. They are staying. So I walked off. And I refused to have anything to do with them. I used to serve all the other people because I used to be the waiter as well. Or part of the time we had a waitress when we were very, very busy. And I refused to serve these people. So Jeff used to have to take off his apron and smarten himself up and take their dinner out to the table. Anyway, this only went on for a day. And I was in the bar the following evening and the chap came up to me and he said, can I buy you a drink? And I said, no, I don't drink when I'm on duty, but thank you for offering. He said, we've decided that we will be staying. I said, oh, I'm pleased about that. And he said, and we'd like to apologise. This is the best hotel we've ever stayed in. And they stayed. And right at the end of their holiday, I think they were with us for a fortnight, actually. He was chatting at the bar and he said, oh, nice little business you got here, haven't you? So I said, well, it's not too bad. He said, oh, cash as well. Oh, he said, I bet that don't go through the books. So I said, everything that goes through that till, well, we didn't have a till, we just had a box on the counter, goes into the books. I said, what line of business are you in? He said, I'm a tax inspector. So you never know who you're talking to. So be very, very careful what you admit to if you get asked difficult questions.
And I think you said before we came on air you quite liked Fawlty Towers.
I did. I so love the programme. And
did you pick up any
best
practice from that programme?
No, but it was a little bit like that. I can tell you, running a hotel is very much like that. And I had the great pleasure of meeting John Cleese literally about 5 years ago, just as we were about to close our department store, and he wandered in one day, and I didn't realise who he was.
Anyway, OK, so you ran the hotel for about 3 years.
Yeah, exactly.
You decided to sell up. Why?
I wasn't very well. Right in the middle of the summer before our last summer, because we actually sold in the middle of the summer, I wasn't very well for about 3 days. I don't know what happened. It was something like flu I picked up, and I was really, really ill. And I just couldn't get out of bed. Luckily, my mum and dad and my sister and brother-in-law were staying with us. And they managed to sort of look after the rooms and things and did the jobs that I should have done. But I, lying in that bed, I thought to myself, oh, my goodness me, supposing it was Jeff that wasn't well, who would cook the guests' dinner? Who would cook their breakfast? I don't cook. I couldn't have done it. And I couldn't have gone up to the fish and chip shop on the corner sort of 3 or 4 days in a row and bought fish and chips for them all, could I? So I thought, I think it's time we sold up.
And I think you said this was the beginning of the downturn in the seaside trade as well.
Yeah, I had noticed over the previous couple of years how the business had changed very, very quickly, very rapidly. Hotels were finding it difficult. The seaside trade was disappearing fast, and they were taking in what we called the Costa del Dol people, who were youngsters who came from places like Liverpool and Birmingham and decided that they would collect their dole at the seaside and spend their days on the beach, which is a good idea, something I should have done. And but you can't mix permanent guests like that with holiday guests, because the young guys would be sitting there drinking a can of lager or whatever it is, and you've got, you know, an elderly couple, because most of the seaside trade was either elderly couples or, well, I won't say youngsters, but possibly guys and girls in their 20s and 30s who would come away for the weekend, you know. They just wanted a weekend away at the seaside. And it didn't mix. And you could see these businesses going out of business very, very quickly. And I thought, no, now is the time to get out. So we did.
So you sold the hotel?
Yep.
What then?
Well, I started in North Wales, or we started in North Wales, with me buying a little cottage.
This was years before.
This was 10 years before. And one of our old vets from the PDSA had come to live at the bottom of our road because he came and stayed at the hotel. He liked it so much he decided to sell his house in Lincolnshire and move to the bottom of our road. And he was going up to Wales for a holiday. And I said, oh, while you're up there, Ken, would you pop into the estate agents and bring me back any details of properties that are up for sale? Because we're selling the hotel and we're going to have a nice lot of money. We can buy whatever we want in North Wales. And he came back a week later and he threw this paper down on the table outside the hotel where we were having coffee. And he said, that's the only place I thought that might interest you. And I looked at it and I said to Jeff, Jeff, look! And it was a house that we had seen 10 years before, just briefly, literally for a matter of, less than a minute as we walked by. And it was a very, very old house, an ancient house, built actually in 1502, as I know now. And I said to Jeff, we're going to live in that house one day. And that's going to be our garden. The garden was full of old-fashioned vegetables and things. And Jeff said, yeah, won't it be lovely? And that was the house that he bought the details of. So I said to Jeff, quick, get inside, phone the estate agents and tell them we'll have it. And we bought it without going and seeing it. And that is the honest truth.
And this was in Festiniog?
It was in Festiniog. Well, officially it was in Mainturo, but Festiniog was the nearest village.
So you'd found a house, but what about income?
Well, we decided that we would go into the gift business. We've got little bit fed up with having people living in the premises all the time. I couldn't sleep. I would hear doors banging in the night. And not big loud bangs, but just boom, you know, as fire doors closing and people wandering about. And I think, oh dear, what's happened now? Because often people would lock themselves out of their rooms or they'd get locked out of the hotel and they'd ring the doorbell at 4 o'clock in the morning. And when you go down, it was because they couldn't find their key, because we used to lock the door at midnight. We didn't want people wandering in off the street. And and then having opened the door, they'd be fumbling in their bag. And they'd say, oh, sorry, oh, I've got the key now. Oh, sorry to get you out of bed. And we decided we didn't want any more of that. And I rather fancied the idea of a gift shop. I used to go into Canterbury and I used to wander around the little gift shops and I thought, oh, that'd be rather nice. Sort of business we should be running. And so we bought a derelict shop and it was derelict. You walked into the shop and you could see the sky up through the three floors where there were rotten holes where the rain had been pouring through the roof for 15 years. The place had been empty 15 years. And yeah, we bought it, £7,500 in 1988, and we spent the winter of 88, 89 digging out tons and tons and tons, absolutely tons and tons and tons of mud and slurry and stuff that had washed down off of the mountain behind it, and we opened the shop in February of 1989. And that was the start of Porphyry and Kemp, as it was then, Porphyry and Kemp's British and Oriental Bazaar.
What a grand name.
Yeah.
Anyway,
it was a grand business.
Let's take your next track, which is Al Green.
Yeah.
Why this one?
Let's Stay Together. Well, Jeff and I, we had a few difficult years in the first 10 years. But we did stay together and we built up a terrific relationship and we built up a terrific business and we spent 42 years of our lives together. And this is a particularly nice record and that's why I chose it.
Let's Stay Together by Al Green.
It's all right with me. spend my life with you. And me say it seems, oh baby, since we've been together, ooh, loving you forever is what I
Al Green, Let's Stay Together, from 1971, and that got voted the 60th greatest song of all time by the Rolling Stone magazine.
Gosh, I didn't know that. It's up for sale, by the way, if you want to buy it. Not the record, I mean the Rolling Stone magazine.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay, I'll give that some thought. Anyway, Paul is our guest in the studio, and Paul, we've got to the point where you are now living in North Wales and you have a gift shop.
Yep.
Which wasn't something you'd previously had any experience of, but nonetheless you built
I worked for the PDSA, hadn't I? And we had gift shops there, but it wasn't the same sort of thing. Gift shops back in my day were nothing like charity gift shops are these days. I mean, they were basically a fixed rummage sale or jumble sale, you know. It was nothing like they are today. They're professionally run. They weren't in my day.
And this business then... it sold what?
We sold all sorts of things. We started off with £1,500 worth of stock that we bought from Stoke-on-Trent. I'd always wanted to go to Stoke-on-Trent, and I was told by many, many people that if you went to Stoke-on-Trent, you could buy stuff at the Potteries. You could buy seconds and things at the Potteries for next to nothing. And so we decided that's what we would do. Now, we had two friends... one of them's mother ran an old people's home in Colwyn Bay. Rose Hill Rest Home. I've just remembered the name of it. And they had an ambulance, a sort of minibus type ambulance that they used to take the old folk out for the day in. And Alan said, right, well, we'll take the minibus. We'll go to Stoke-on-Trent and we'll get you some pottery. So I got £1,500 out of the bank and we went to Stoke-on-Trent and we loaded this... minibus come ambulance up with all sorts of mugs and pottery and all interesting things. And we took them back. We got back to Blaenau-Ffestiniog, where the shop was, all quite late at night. And we laid it all out on the tables. We got some old tables that somebody had lent us. And we laid it all out. And the next morning we opened. And I think we took, I'm just trying to think, on the first day I think we took £20, something like that. The average takings for that shop was probably around about £30 a day, which wasn't a lot even then. But you've got to remember, if I was working at Woolworths down the other end of the town, I probably would have only been earning, oh, I don't know, £120 a week, something like that, if that. Perhaps just £100 a week. So it was worth, it was actually making money. The property didn't cost much. The rates were very, very tiny, the rates. I think it was something like £32 a year. It was very, very small, the rates. And with me being very careful with the electricity and things, the lighting and the electricity bills were not very high. And we prospered in a small sort of way. And we liked the idea of running a gift shop. And then about, 5-6 months later, we saw a shop for sale in Bala. And don't forget, we got some money in our pockets because we'd sold the hotel for nearly three times what we paid for it. And we decided that we would buy a shop in Bala. And Jeff ran the shop in Bala. I ran the one in Blaenau-Ffestiniog. The one in Bala, the one in Blaenau-Ffestiniog was taking, as I say, probably 30, 40, I think I took £60 one day. The shop in Bala was taking £500-£700 a day. And we suddenly became, quite well off, to be truthful with you. And we decided to open a shop in Bournemouth. Yeah, we liked the bees, you see. Blaenau-Ffestiniog, Bala, Bournemouth. Only 250 miles apart, the Bournemouth and the Bella shops, but that's not a problem. And we just sort of grew. Slowly we grew into a small chain of shops. We opened a shop in Wimborne. And then we decided to sell the two shops in North Wales, sell the house, sell the two shops in North Wales. And we wanted to go to the New Forest. We tried and tried and tried to buy a shop in Lyndhurst. No success. We nearly bought an old pub, which we was going to turn into a hotel with a gift shop downstairs. And luckily, we were pipped to the post literally within a couple of hours of us signing the contract. And I'm very pleased about that. And we ended up buying a little shop in Lymington. And we were made, absolutely made. The takings there, I think the first year was over 100,000. And we just grew and grew and grew. And there was an old department store further down the street that Jeff always wanted to buy. And he kept saying to me, oh, I'd like that shop, I'd like that shop. And I said, Jeff, the roof leaks. It's terrible. Have you ever looked in there? They've got buckets everywhere collecting the drips. And the building was actually built in 1960. So it wasn't an old building, but it had a flat roof. And that was the problem. And one day, the old chap who was the managing director of Ford & Company in Lymington, he said to me and Jeff, he said, oh, you must come over and see my garden. All the flowers are lovely. Oh, dear. I said to Jeff as we walked to the shop, I said, look, you go over and look at his blooming garden, but I'm not going over there because I know what you're getting at. You want me to buy that shop, and there's no way I want to buy it. Anyway, he went over, he looked at the shop, looked at the flowers in the garden. And he came back and he said, you'll have to go. He'll be so upset if you don't go. So I said, all right, I'll go and look at his blooming garden, but I'm not going to look at the shop. I'm going to walk straight through the shop, look at the garden, and I'll be straight back. So I went over and I asked to speak to Mr. Ford, and I was told, oh, no, it's Mr. Isted. He's the managing director. And I was shown to his office, and it was like stepping back in time. The office was, well, something out of I don't know, we say Scrooge or something like that. It was so old-fashioned, with two huge safes and these pictures all around the walls of the old business as it was in the 1890s. Absolutely amazing. And I fell in love with the place. And I, within a minute of being there, I said to Mr. Isted, I said, I gather you're up for sale. He said, yeah, I can't sell it, boy. He said, just can't sell it. I said, well, in that case, I'd better buy it. So he said, what do you mean? I said, I'd like to buy the shop. He said, you don't want to buy this? Oh, a bit of millstone round your neck. You don't want to buy this? You stick in your little shop up the road. You're making money up there. You won't make any money here. Anyway, before I left, I'd done the deal. I'd arranged the price. I'd knocked him down a little bit on his price. Well, quite a bit, actually. And I'd arranged to pay for half of the business, half of the building, immediately. And that we would pay for the other half of the business, or we'd be giving the other half of the money for the shop in 6 months' time when we'd had an opportunity to sell the shop further up the road, or if not, we would have got a bank loan or something. And the deal was done. He said, well, I'll have to check with the other directors of the business because I'm only the managing director. I don't have full authority to make decisions. He said, and I will write to you. My secretary comes in on a Tuesday and a Thursday. She'll be in on Thursday and I'll get her to write to you. And I said, well, there's no need to do that. Just pop across the road and tell us. Oh, no, we have to do things properly, he said. So in due course, on Friday, a letter arrived in the post. He'd had to walk past our shop to get to the postbox, by the way. But it arrived in the post on Friday morning saying that they would be delighted to accept our offer. And we bought C. Ford & Company, Lymington, founded in 1840.
So you went out to have a look at his flowers.
Oh, no, I never saw the garden.
You never got that far?
No, I never got that far. I didn't see the garden.
But that's why you went there, but you ended up buying the shop instead.
Yeah, ended up buying the shop, and I was dead against it for a number of years.
So how did you explain that to Jeff when you got back?
I just went back and said, oh, by the way, he said, what do you think of the garden? I said, well, I didn't actually see the garden, but we're buying the shop. We're what? I said, we're buying the shop. I said, you've always wanted it. Why don't you admit that you've always... Well, I know I do, but where are we going to pay for it? I said, it's all sorted. I've dealt with it. And that is actually the last property deal that I... Oh, no, I didn't. That is the last property deal that I did. After that, I used to put Jeff in charge of all those things. I couldn't be bothered.
Right, OK, that's a bit bizarre, really.
Should we have another record?
Yes, have another record. Why not? How about a Charles Aznavour?
Yeah. When I first met Jeff, he was mad, absolutely mad about Charles Aznavour, and he bought all his records. And the next track is one that reminds me of him so much. She.
She. Yeah. OK, let's have She by Charles Aznavour.
She may be the face I can't forget, a trace of pleasure or regret, maybe my treasure or the price I have to pay. She may be the song that summer sings, maybe the chill that autumn brings, maybe 100 different things within the measure of a day. She may be the beauty or the beast, maybe the famine or the feast, may turn each day into a heaven or a hell. She may be the mirror of my dream, a smile reflected in a stream. She may not be what she may seem inside her shell. She always seems so happy in a crowd, whose eyes can be so private and so proud. No one's allowed to see them when they cry. She may be the love that cannot hope to last, may come to me from shadows of the past that I remember till the day I die. She may be the reason I survive, the why and wherefore I'm alive, the one I'll care for through the rough and red years. Me, I'll take her laughter and her tears, and make them all my souvenirs. For where she goes, I've got to be. The meaning of my life is she. She.
The wonderful Charles Aznavour and She from 1974. It was 4 weeks at number one. And Charles Aznavour is now 93 years old.
Is he still with us?
He's still with us.
Do you know, I wondered if he was. I was listening to his records yesterday, and I thought, I wonder if the poor old boy's still around. He's still here. Jeff will be so pleased.
I'm not sure if he's still singing, might you?
Yeah. Well, not. Jeff, now, I don't mean this in an unkind way, but Jeff always used to call him Charles has no voice. But he loved him. I mean, he bought all his records, so we helped him become a multi-millionaire by buying his records.
Many a popular singer has become very successful without necessarily the best voice.
Well, look at me. You see, that's my next career. I should be a singer.
Yes, well, you've certainly done enough of varied proportions in life that could happen, Paul.
It's funny, you know, during your life you think to yourself, I haven't done anything interesting whatsoever. And I look at people like you and a lot of the guys and girls that work here on the radio station, and I think, cool, they've led such exciting lives. And I've done nothing. And then I stop and I think, I do a lot of thinking these days, and I think, you know, you have had a lot of fun. And one of the last things that Jeff said to me before he died, and he wrote it in my birthday card this year, and he said, Paul, we had some fantastic adventures. And we did.
Well, it certainly sounds like that. And I don't think too many people listening to these programmes will have come to the conclusion that you've had a dull life. You've had a very interesting life so far. And, you know, it ain't over yet.
And that's only the bits I tell you about.
Yeah, that's right. Well, episode 4, maybe some of those other bits.
Oh, I don't know about that.
But let's pick it up again. You're now the brand new owners of a department store in Lymington.
Yes.
But did you still have other business? You obviously had the shop up the road.
Yeah, we had the shop, the little shop up the road where I stayed. I stayed in the little shop. Jeff moved over to, because I always gave him the easy jobs. he moved over to the department store. And when we actually took the shop over, the store over, there were 5 items of stock. That's all they had left. And this is the honest truth. They just had 5 items of stock. I'm trying to remember what they were. I can think of 3 of them. There was a rug, a little mat, sort of fireside mat. There was a chair. There was a painting. Well, it wasn't a painting, a sort of print picture of a ship. And there were 2 other things. I can't think what they were, but there were 5 items of stock, and they'd spread them out. You could imagine the shop was the size of a Marks and Spencer store. That was the sort of building. It looked like a Marks and Spencer store with the big windows. And all it had in the window were these 5 items of stock. Huge counters with nothing on them. Huge racks where they used to sell pillows and rolls of linen and rolls of material and all sorts of things. Completely empty.
So it had been run down. It wasn't really a going concern.
Oh, no. They'd run it down because they were going to close it up. They were going to board the building up. If we hadn't come along, it was going to be boarded up. I was told that. And we had a shop in Bournemouth, which we actually closed the day that Princess Di was tragically killed in the road accident in Paris.
August 97, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly 20 years ago. And that is when we bought the department store. We bought the department store then. And everything that was in the Bournemouth shop was transferred over to the shop in Lymington, the department store in Lymington. And the shop in Bournemouth was only small. I forget the square footage, but it was only a small shop. And the stock looked absolutely lost in this huge building, which was amazingly large. You know, the ground floors just stretched into the distance when it was empty. So Jeff and the last remaining member of the C. Ford and Company staff, who'd been with the business since he was about 16, I think, Brian, and Jeff and he, they displayed our stock on a few trestle tables right at the front of the shop, and they built a sort of wall, a barrier, with these sort of temporary sort of room-setting walls that they had a lot of because they used to sell furniture. And gradually, as stock came in and we got extra stock, the little walls were moved back. And gradually we filled the building up bit by bit. But we started selling things that we'd never sold before, like sheets and duvets and pillows and towels and furniture. We'd never sold furniture. So we started selling suites of furniture, recliner chairs. And then we went into the fine chinas. We'd done all the stuff from Stoke-on-Trent, but we decided we wanted to do bone china. And we got in touch with Royal Doulton, and Royal Doulton refused to deal with us. And I got in touch with Royal Doulton again, and they refused to deal with us. And I wrote again, and they still didn't reply. And then about a year later, we were in the shop, and the telephone rang. And this guy said, "Oh, hello, Mr. Peters." So I said, "Yes." He said, I can't think of his name now. "I'm Mr. So-and-so. I'm the managing director of Doulton UK. So I said, "Oh, yes." I said, "But you won't supply us." "Oh," he said, "I know." He said, "I've got numerous letters here from you that have never been answered." I said, "Yes, that's right. Can I come and see you?" So I said, "Well, if you want to." I said, "But we're not a huge shop. I don't care whether you're the size of a tobacconist." He said, "We would like to come and see you." So a date was fixed, and this, there were 3 big black cars, big black limousines arrived from Royal Doulton. And it was the managing directors of all the different bits of Royal Doulton. They came and actually spent the day with us. And by the end of the day, they had instructed the rep who covered our area, who had refused to have anything to do with us in the past, because they were frightfully snooty, we will say. I can say that now because they're out of business. They're no longer there. And by the end of the day, the rep had been instructed that he was to call at the shop the next morning to take an order. And he was furious. He arrived at 9 o'clock. He was absolutely furious. He said, "Well, minimum order's £12,000. I said, "Oh, is that all?" "Oh, I thought it would be much more than that." So he said, "Yes, if you can't get up to £12,000, I'm not prepared to take an order." I said, "Well, that's not what your managing director said." I said, "But if that's what you want, fair enough." I said, "Sit down and we'll do the order." We spent all day trying to get to £12,000. And when it got to 11,500, he said, well, I think that'll be fine. He said, I've got to get home because I live in Margate. I said, really? We used to have a hotel there. And we saw the mighty fall, because he was a frightfully important person at Royal Doulton. And gradually, as their business sort of declined, he ended up being given a second-hand car.
Oh dear.
And he became the only rep for Royal Doulton. And then they actually went out of business. They were taken over by Wedgwood, went out of business. I shouldn't have said that, should I?
Oh, it doesn't matter. Nobody's listening.
Oh, I hope they are.
Right, we've got another two records. Let's take your penultimate one, which is Paul Anka.
Yeah, lovely song. I just like it.
Something About You. And
yeah, Something About You. And that's... Perhaps I shouldn't say a lot of the things I'm saying on here, but this reminds me of Jeff.
Okay.
I see you and I want you. Something about you, baby, drives me wild. Something about you, baby, drives me crazy. Something's got me acting like a child. When I touch you, it's like the first time. Something about you makes me feel this way. Something about you's got me feeling hazy. Something about you makes me wanna say, so you'll never know. Loving you has gone and done to me, done to me. I see in you the need in me, the need to be fulfilled by what I see.
Something About You from 1974, and he's a Canadian-American singer. He's still with us as well. He's now 76.
Yeah, oh yes. Yeah. I like Paul Anka. I remember the early ones, Diana. Ooh, yeah. Yeah, long before your time.
Yeah, but yes, indeed. Paul is our guest in the studio, and we've been talking about how you came to acquire the business in Lymington, the larger business, having had a small business there. But you bought this department store, which had been really run down and it was to close, and you went through the process of building it back up again. And
yeah, we did.
Bringing in stock and buying stock, and then, as you say, about forming relationships with major suppliers.
Yeah. We ended up selling Moorcroft Pottery. We sold Royal Doulton, Wedgwood, all of the big names we supplied. And Royal Crown Derby was one of our favourites. And all that sort of stuff sold well. It probably doesn't sell now because things have changed and people don't like clutter. And little bits and pieces that you buy and put on your mantelpiece that cost £100 or £200 or whatever, they're just not selling now. They just don't sell.
But the community must have loved you because this shop was about to go out of business. And
well, they did.
You came in,
yeah,
and
because Livington
gave it a
is.
New lease of life.
Oh yes, yeah. I mean, to start with, they would come in and they could be a little bit snooty. Some of the ladies in Livington, and they would say, "Oh, sir, have you watched Sam's hair?" And we'd say, "No, I'm terribly sorry, madam, we haven't." "Oh dear, I'll have to go to Tyrrell's then." Well, Tyrrell's was the Tyrrell and Green's was the name of the John Lewis store in Southampton. But after a while, that seemed to drop. And I think the reason was because we sold things at a very good price. And I'm not just saying this. We would negotiate. Jeff worked for a supermarket chain. And he was a buyer for a supermarket chain for quite a while. And he knew how to deal with companies. So we would go to a big company, one of our big linen suppliers, and we would say, right, okay, then what's the best deal you can do on this? And I would then come in and I would say, you know, do we get a discount for sort of paying within 7 days? We don't get offered that very often. Most people take 160 days or whatever it is. Can I just use your phone? And they would phone head office, and head office would say, yeah, we can let you have 2.5% if you pay within 7 days. And I would then say to the rep, what about if I give you a check as you leave? If they can work out an invoice while you're here having your cup of tea and then phone back with the amount, I'll write you a check now. Can they knock a little bit more off? And he'd go back on the phone and he'd come back and say, yeah, 3.75 if you pay me now. And that's what we used to do. So that gave us 3.75 extra to play with. Well, we didn't keep that extra 3.75%. We knocked that off of the price. So it meant that we were undercutting people like John Lewis, who are never knowingly undersold. And we used to get lots of funny phone calls. And it was obviously the likes of John Lewis and companies like that who would phone up and say, oh, do you stock so-and-so, so-and-so by Fogarty? It's serial number is XYZ, so-and-so, so-and-so. We'd say, yes, can you tell me your price? And we'd say, oh, it's $19.99. Thank you. And the phone would go down. And you knew that they were price checking because somebody had quoted the price that we were selling the particular item at, and they were trying to get it, well, the same from the other company. But that paid off well because companies knew that they could rely on us to pay within 7 days or pay immediately. So we used to get offered all sorts of bargains. And particularly from the linen companies who manufacture, especially for, we say, John Lewis and Marks and Spencers and the big companies. And they would come in and they would say, right, we've made these goose down pillows for Marks and Spencers. They sell at $49.95 or whatever it is. $39.95, I'm exaggerating. $39.95 in Marks and Spencers, a pair of goose down pillows. We've got quite a lot left over because we always make more. If you're interested, you can have them for £7.50 a pair. We have to cut the label out, the Marks and Spencer's label, but we'll put a stitch in a label, a Fogarty label, and you can have them. And I'd say to Jeff, ask him how many they've got. Jeff said, how many have you got, Martin? Well, actually, we've got 400 in stock, but you haven't got to take them all. They're £7.50 if you want them. I'd say to Jeff, right, ask him if they come down to a fiver. Jeff would say, don't suppose you could come down to £5, could you, Martin? Oh, I don't think so. Can I phone the office? Yeah, you phone the office. He'd come back and say, they'll come down to 5.50. And I'd say to Jeff, because I was the one that used to give him the bullets to fire, I'd whisper to him in his ear and I'd say, ask him if we can have them all, if we take them all 400, if we can still have them for a fiver. So he'd say, well, suppose we took all 400, Martin. Could you come down to a fiver then? You'd be willing to take the lot, would you? Well, yeah, if you can come down to a fiver. Hold on a minute, I'll go and phone them again. He'd come back and say, yeah, they've said, we'll take a fiver, but can I take a cheque back with me? Jeff would say, can he take a cheque back with him? Yeah, that's all right, Martin. Should I go and put the kettle on? And that was how we did our business. And that meant that we had these wonderful, wonderful bargains. People like Stella that we dealt with, the cookware people, we would be offered fantastic bargains. there might be a saucepan set that's been selling at 190 odd quid. Beautiful, beautiful saucepans. That line had come to an end because they're continually changing these things. And they would come to us and they would say, look, we've got 37 of these in stock in our warehouse. They sell at £195 or whatever a set. If you're interested, you can have them for 20 quid a set. We just want to get rid of them. And again, we would say, right, OK, then, we'll have the lot. Can we get a little bit more, you know, another 10% possibly? They'd say, yeah, go on then. We'd throw in a few other bits to make up the price. So we'd get that that set of saucepans, that, you know, all of the saucepans, and they might send us another five of somebody else that they got stuck on the shelf they wanted to get rid of. And that made good, good profits. And that built the business up. The business grew and it was unbelievable, the amount of stock that we had in the end. It just grew and it grew and it grew. And we never, ever borrowed a penny. We never had a mortgage and we never owed a penny. So we had a fantastic name in business and we never bought what we couldn't afford. So if we couldn't afford it, we didn't have it. And that is the way I am now.
It's all good, basic, common sense business practice, isn't it, really?
Yeah,
but you made a huge success out of the business.
Well, we did, yeah. But the bankers didn't like us. Because
you didn't want to borrow anything.
No, we didn't want to borrow anything. And we never paid bank charges either. we knew how to get free banking, and we had free banking. In fact, I closed our business account literally last month. I wrote to Bank of Scotland and closed the account after all the years we had free banking for life from Bank of Scotland, and I closed the account because I no longer needed. But we never paid bank charges. We never paid a penny to the bank. We couldn't get round getting free credit card things. That was the only thing that used to annoy us, because we had to pay for credit cards and debit cards, but there was no way we could get that free.
Paul, we're running short on time. We're going a little bit over again. We've got to take your final track in a moment, but how long did you keep the business? What year did you finally decide to sell up?
We didn't sell. We let the building, and that was just over 5 years ago. We had decided that we wanted to part with the business. Jeff had had a heart attack, I can't remember, say 13, 14 years ago, something, 13 years ago. And I wanted him to have a little bit of time to himself. I wanted him to be able to get out in the garden.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we decided that we would part with it. We didn't want to sell the building. We were offered millions, literally, for the building. But we didn't want that. So we had a succession of people that said they wanted to rent it from us, including Peacocks and M & Company and the original factory shop. But they all dropped out by the wayside. It wasn't quite big enough for them. They wanted something a little bit bigger. And then we remembered that not long after we first bought the building, we were pestered for 6 months by J.D. Weatherspoon, who wanted to buy the building off of us. And they kept... He phoned three times a week. This is the honest truth. And I said to Jeff, oh, Mr. Crisp's on the phone for you. Oh, God, what does he want? And I'd say, well, you know what he wants. And the final time that this Mr. Crisp phoned, he offered a phenomenal amount of money for the building. And Jeff said, no, I'm not interested. And he said, well, I'm offering you, you could buy a department store in Southampton. So Jeff said, well, if you think Southampton's so blooming good, why don't you go there? He said, we're already there. We've got three branches in Southampton. So we decided that we would get our agents to get in touch with J.D. Weatherspoon. And they sent a guy down literally within 2 hours who walked around the building and said, perfect. He said, I'm going to recommend that they take it on. And they were absolutely fantastic. Fantastic company to deal with. Very, very professional company, extremely nice, and people knock them, I shouldn't say that perhaps on air, but they were extremely professional, very, very nice people to deal with. And so we let them rent the building.
Well, I think that's probably a good place to stop, isn't it? And I think there may be a part four here, might there, in maybe a few weeks'
five
time.
Five or six or seven, you know.
Yeah, well, we've got semi-up to date, haven't we?
Yeah, we're not far out now.
Paul, thank you for that. And let's take your final track to close with. And this is Charles Aznavour again.
Yeah.
Why this one?
Again, it reminds me of Jeff.
Yes. This is We Had It All.
And we did.
Yeah. Well, you did, didn't you, really? Yeah. You did tremendously well. And this is from 1972. It's originally a Waylon Jennings song from 1973. And it's also been recorded by, well, who? Conway Twitty?
Really?
Dolly Parton?
Oh, Dolly Parton.
So let's have it. And Paul, it's been a great pleasure chatting to you again. Thank you for coming in.
It's been a pleasure.
And we'll pick up the final part in a few weeks' time, maybe.
Okay. Bye for now.
Thanks,
bye-bye.
Paul.
Where do you go? What do you do? When everything you do reminds you of all the love that's now behind you. She's gone, and here I am alone. She had a way so right for me, made just as if someone had planned it, and yet I took it all for granted. Nobody's fault except my own. We had it all, the two of us, all of the love for life and laughter. Never thought what might come after. We were love's children out to play. We had it all right in our hands. Life was so beautiful together. I thought our love would last forever. Then I let it slip away. What can I say? What can I do? To kill the guilt that comes to haunt me. What words are there to make her want me, to make her take me back again? Is this the end of all we have? Is this what fate has written?